This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Singeri. Everybody has a story to share about a bizarre or amazing coincidence. But what can math tell us about how unbelievable these seemingly random occurrences actually are? Joseph Mazur is a mathematician and professor emeritus at Marlborough College. This spring, we interviewed him about his new book, Fluke, The Math and the Myth of Coincidence. In it, he relates the stories of astounding coincidences, including one where he and his own brother bumped into each other in a foreign country when neither knew the other was traveling abroad. Mazur joined Vermont Edition's Jane Lindholm in April to explain the math behind coincidences.
Professor Mazur, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Jane, for having me on your wonderful show.
Oh, well, thank you for being here. And I guess you have to tell us this story of how you and your brother happened to find each other in a foreign country.
Well, it is somewhat of a typical story of meeting people you know in very foreign places. I was on a Greek island. It was many, many years ago when I was traveling on a Greek island. And I was in a very, very tiny, small village at a taverna and sitting and having a coffee. And I heard in a distance, quite a distance, a laugh that I knew was quite familiar. And I turned around and looked, and I saw my own brother with other people and other people I knew as well.
So does that say more about your family closeness, perhaps, than the amazement of the coincidence?
It says that it's a wonderful story. That's really what it says. And, you know, we're blessed with all these wonderful stories. And, you know, the whole history of the world is a great story. And I feel that many of these stories are just wonderful to hear, especially the coincidence stories.
Is that really the impetus then behind this book? As a mathematician, are you just looking for an excuse to get some of these stories out there?
No. Well, it all started at a residency in Italy. I was with a number of guests at a compound in Italy. And I at breakfast each morning, somebody would come down and say, "I have a wonderful coincidence to tell you." And I would analyze the coincidence as a mathematician and say, "Well, you know, it is a coincidence, but it here's the likelihood of it happening." And the next morning, the same person would come down again with another coincidence story. And this would repeat over and over again until one day she said, "You know, you should write a book about coincidences." That's where it all began.
And there it began.
I said, "I don't want to write a book about coincidences. I know nothing about coincidences." But it turns out that I now do.
Yes, and I hear you now get stories from everybody in the world who hears that you've written a book about
coincidences. Once people know that you're writing a book on coincidences, you hear them all the time.
Well, we want to hear more of them today. So listeners, please continue to share. As I said, we've been getting a ton of them. You can find other people's stories on the Vermont Edition Facebook page where you can add your own. Or you can go to vpr.net and click on Vermont Edition and add your story there. Or you can give us a call, 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. We're going to share some of these stories, and then I hope Professor Mazur won't ruin the amazement we have by talking
about... I'll try not to.
By talking about how likely these stories actually are. I'll read you a few. Colleen just posted on Facebook, "Just this morning I was thinking about a time when my pal Eric approached me on the street in Johnson, Vermont, wearing a shirt I had made in high school 5 years prior to that. I'd given the shirt to a Salvation Army in Hartford, Connecticut, and I hadn't seen the shirt or thought of it in years until Eric came walking down the street wearing it, 5 years later and two states away. I thought about that this morning, and then on my way to work, I heard this would be today's subject." Cool stuff.
Double coincidence.
You have in your book. You have some double and triple coincidences.
Triple coincidences,
as well.
Yes.
We got a note from Marnie who says, "I have experienced many instances of being somewhere and having my path unexpectedly cross with someone I know. So much so that my friends have come to expect this to occur whenever I travel. The most unusual and amazing experience was in Moscow on an April night in 1990, when the country was still the Soviet Union. I was traveling with a group from Vermont known as the Children's Art Exchange. I had attended Easter evening service at a Russian Orthodox church. It was expected to be a crowded situation, and our Russian guide made sure to tell us exactly where the tour bus would pick us up after the service, knowing we'd probably get separated. I was standing at the prescribed spot waiting for others in the group to make their way, and as I stood in the darkness, the woman next to me at the curb, not part of our group, began to turn toward me. I don't speak Russian, and as she turned, I worried I'd have a struggle to even help her understand my limitations. I was completely surprised when she said, "I don't know your name, but I know you live in Middlebury, Vermont." As I looked at her, I responded immediately with, "I don't know your name, but I know you live in Middlebury, Vermont." We began a wonderful conversation immediately. She was with a group of students from the college. Several years ago, I was relating this incident to a new friend while sitting by the Otter Creek in Middlebury. Just as I finished relating this amazing situation of years past, the same woman walked up with a small group of friends, and we laughed once again about the timing. So there again.
Another double coincidence.
And
these are wonderful.
Is
really.
That rare, or do
well,
people often have those?
We now learn that we are blessed with the number of coincidences, a number of acquaintances and friends that we do have. That's the beauty of it. The wonderful thing is that we ignore the vastness of our friendships, and we also ignore the vastness of the world. We have no conception of how big the world is and also how small the world is when we include our friends. In other words, the groups that we know and are part of. So, I mean, for example, you know, the world is unimaginably and frighteningly vast. Just to give some impression of just how vast it is, let's count the seconds to three. One, two, three. Now take a guess. The reader, the listeners should take a guess at how many barcode scans worldwide passed in those 3 seconds.
Whoa. I have no idea.
Would you like to take a guess, Jane?
A million.
That's a pretty good guess, but it's pretty high. I was hoping
really?
You were going to say 10,000.
I thought
but
commerce,
this is
you know.
3 seconds. Just 3 seconds. It's about 200,000.
Oh,
but that
wow.
still is, you know, if you were to ask me before I researched this topic, I would say, 10,000, maybe 50,000.
I'm just
but
thinking of how fast the cashiers are at the grocery store. They
well,
could scan a lot of items in
right,
3 seconds.
That's right. Worldwide, it's about 200,000,
wow.
according to Nielsen estimates. Huh. By the time we count to 40, you know, somebody in the world will have committed suicide. I don't want to bring in that kind of dark side to it. But we have to understand how big the world really is. And we usually have our own impressions are that it's much smaller than it actually is. So we bring it down to our comfort level by telling and hearing coincidence stories that make the world shrink. And we crave that comfort. It's also a reason, in my opinion, why we love stories in general.
But doesn't it seem like that vastness would increase the amazement that you could ever run into somebody you know in a strange place or have these coincidences?
It's vast, but for us, you know, our enclave, our neighborhood, and I'm using neighborhood in a metaphorical sense, our neighborhood is much bigger than we really think it is. So that when we take a vacation, we want to go someplace, well, we are friends. And our acquaintances are likely, fairly likely, to be going or thinking about going to roughly the same places. When, you know, most people are not going to the outskirts of, you know, people I know anyhow don't seem to be, I don't know, I shouldn't say where they would go. But I would say that they are going to the places we would normally go to, too.
We got another note from Dave in Middlebury who says, is it possible that some people experience more fluky coincidences than others? I often feel like I've had more of them than normal, and I feel like Vermonters in general have more of them than normal.
I think it's because Dave is noticing them more than other people. A lot of it has to do with the noticing. You notice if you're very aware of things and you process things in terms of notifying yourself about these things, you're more aware that something is going to happen and something will happen. I mean, it comes down to the whole question of what Jung once called synchronicity. That is, it's all in the noticing, but there's something in the mind that's already there that's waiting for the next thing to happen, and you're going to be noticing it more.
All right, one more comment here, and then I want to get into some of these probabilities and what you've been looking at, Professor Mazur. Gary in Richmond says, 28 years ago, I was going to UVM and taking a night class in the Living and Learning Center. After class, I was waiting for a truck to pass at the Main Street crosswalk to get to my vehicle to drive home. I was hungry and deciding whether or not to drive to Al's French Fries to get a cup of fries. Usually, there were many people in vehicles at this time of night, but at this moment, there was only me and the unmarked truck. Just as the box truck was in front of me, it hit a frost heave and the back door slid up and a box slid out onto the road. Then the door slid back down and closed. The driver didn't notice and continued on. I went over to the box and, of course, it contained 6 5-pound bags of frozen French fries.
That's wonderful. See, that's just a wonderful story. Yeah, and if that isn't synchronicity, I don't know what is.
We are talking today about coincidence and what mathematics tells us about the probability and possibility of these strange things that happen to us. We have more of your stories to share. You can call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or you can post a note on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Professor Mazur, can you tell us what the difference is between a fluke, serendipity, and coincidence?
Yes. A coincidence for me is an event where two events actually colliding in metaphorical space and time, where the cause of that collision is not apparent, and also that that has to have some kind of a surprise. So that's what a coincidence is. Now, once you say that, you have to realize that I use the word non-apparent, which is a kind of a vague word in some sense because it's relative to the person who it's addressed to. That is it non-apparent to everybody or is it non-apparent to the person who is experiencing the coincidence? So there's a kind of a rough spot there. Everything has a cause, unless you're talking about, let's say, quantum physics. But everything would have a cause if you're not talking about anything like Jung's synchronicity. But with the cause, if the cause is discovered, then the coincidence demotes itself to a fluke. In other words, the fluke is there is a cause, and the cause is a little bit more obvious, and you can pick out the cause pretty clearly. In a fluke, that is, once you analyze it.
Hmm.
Once you get to serendipity, well, that's luck, really, and it's a matter of mostly good luck. In other words, serendipitous things are usually lucky things that are in a good way lucky.
Hmm. Since we're talking about definitions here, I'm going to read us one more here from Andrea, who says, on a local citizen website, the moderator posts old articles from the 1800s local paper and had posted a word game from one of those editions. Long story short, the word solution was honorific abilitudinity. Included in the game were several other old words, and I was bemoaning that the Oxford English Dictionary online subscription rate was so high that I couldn't afford it because I wanted to check some of the words, including, of course, this word of honor, so to speak. Well, at the exact moment I was posting my bemoaning, my email notification scrolled across the top of my screen saying my word from the word of the day from the OED was being delivered, and that word, incredibly, was honorific abilitudinity. What are the chances that the moderator would have posted this word game that he randomly found in an old 1800s newspaper from Brattleboro, decided to post that particular one that day, that it would be the OED's word for the day, that my bemoaning the OED would occur at the exact moment my word for the day notice came in from the OED?
I hope that the caller has posted this because I'd really like to see this and analyze this. I would be happy to figure out something that would give us a sense of the odds of that happening.
Oh, do you want Andrea to get in touch with you? She posted it on
Well,
our
if
Facebook
she posted
page.
It post it on your website, then I'll get it
good.
As well.
That'd be great. It's on the Vermont Edition Facebook page.
But, you know, I have another one very similar to that. It's somewhat similar, and I wrote about it in the book a little bit. I was vacuuming my little cottage in Vermont, and the vacuum cleaner got too close to my dictionary. It's at least a 1,200-page dictionary. And it got too close to the dictionary, and it sucked in one page.
And because you leave the dictionary open.
I leave the dictionary open at the spine because I don't want to break the spine. It's a big dictionary, so I leave it open at the spine. So a few minutes, not too much time, went by. Now, this is actually a true story, and I was the only one there, so I have no no
we
backup.
We just have to take your word for
it. Yeah, you'll have to take my word for it. So it turned out that just moments later, it might have been a half an hour later, let's say, I realized that I had to look up the actual definition of synchronicity. And you can guess what page that synchronicity was on.
Yeah, so now you have no idea what the word
means. I had
no
idea from that dictionary. That's true.
Let's go to Jim calling in from East Randolph. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. This story was related to me a few years ago. It's a sort of a two-parter, and it goes back a number of years ago. A friend was hanging out with others during hunting season. The others had a friend visiting from California who was a trooper out there. And my friend and this guy hit it off so well that the guy gave him his ball cap that said CHP on it. So then flash forward a few years, someone had to move, another friend had to move out to Vegas for a job and hired my friend and two other friends to help him. They finished. He rented them a car to drive back to Vermont with. Well, the driver was a lot kind of ADD and left at all hours of the morning and took a wrong turn out of Vegas, and they ended up going into California. And they had crossed the line, and they're trying to convince the driver that, indeed, they're in California. And finally, hey, there's a trooper, a California Highway Patrolman on the side. So they pulled over to convince the guy that they were really in California and headed the wrong way. And during the conversation, my friend and this patrolman looked at each other, and my friend happened to be wearing that CHP ball cap. And lo and behold, it was the same guy.
Wow. That's pretty cool, Jim. And, you know, people who maybe are of a certain era will remember the show Chips. And anybody who lived in California knows CHP, California Highway Patrol. What a cool story. Thanks for that, Jim.
Thank you. That is a very nice story.
We have another Jim. What are the odds, Professor Mazur? We have another Jim calling in from Colchester. Let's go right to him. Hi, Jim.
The How odds are pretty good, by the way.
Yes, that's true.
Mine happened in Baffin Island. And hello?
Hi, we're listening.
Here. Okay, we were hiking up in Baffin Island. The first time we made it up to the glaciers, and we're there, and there was a couple of people across the way from us. We couldn't go over there. And we asked them where they were from. They were from Vermont, and they were circumnavigating the globe by going above the Arctic Circle. A couple of years later, we go back to Baffin Island, and after our tour, we go back to this little Inuit village, Pangerton, and while I was away, a school teacher came up, and he offered to let us go to the high school, or the school, and get so we could take showers. I'm walking into the schoolhouse, and the guy taps me on the shoulder, and he goes, "Oh, hi, Jim. I haven't seen you in a while." It turns out that he was a rugby player from McGill that I used to play rugby against.
Jim, how cool. What a coincidence. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah. I appreciate it. We are talking today about coincidence and what mathematics tells us about the probability and possibility of strange things happening. We have more of your stories coming up and more with Joseph Mazur, author of Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, including how do we know what the odds are? That seems to be the tagline for so many stories. What are the odds? Well, we'll talk about that coming up. You're listening to Vermont Edition.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari. We're listening to our discussion in April with Vermont mathematician Joseph Mazur. His book is called Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. Jane Lindholm talked with Mazur about how so many events that seem like random coincidence are actually explainable through math. And many listeners joined in with their own stories. Here's Jane.
Sue emailed to say, I live in Vermont, but was in a restaurant in Lima, Peru, when someone approached me and called my name. I hadn't met her, but someone I had known was in Peru and gave them a brief description of me, as she too was headed for Peru. Sue goes on, we were both there to adopt baby girls. Then, years later, the girls became lab partners in their high school science class. When I heard about my daughter's lab partner and put it all together, I find this amazing. Two very much entwined coincidences. You wanted to comment on that?
Yes, I do. First, these meeting people in strange places, that is a category of coincidences that is the most likely to happen, actually. And the way my book is structured is that I have essentially 10 stories in the book. And these stories are very, very well vetted. They're accurate and they're true.
Although you do talk about, not in the 10 stories, but at the beginning, you talk about your vacuum cleaner incident, and I have no way of verifying that. So I just want to point out.
That's not one of the 10 stories.
No, that's true.
I just tell it in the introduction, I believe. But that's not one of the classification
that's right.
stories. So the 10 stories are classifying 10 categories of coincidences. And each of those is a representative of the category that it represents. But I want to be careful. I want people to understand that it's impossible to analyze these stories so sharply as to assign some precise odds. Besides, I wouldn't want to.
Mm-hmm.
In my book, I categorize stories, the 10 stories, such as meetings in strange places, winning the lottery. Events that come together in precise timings, events that come together in imprecise timings, dreams that come true, that sort of thing.
Abraham Lincoln's dreams were these sort of premonitions of mm-hmm. big important events to come that
That's
something
right.
always
his,
happened.
His own assassination yeah. included. Then I tell one story from each category as a representative, and I analyze each story and come up with representative odds for each. But let's not take those odds as some serious number that is exact. The point for me is to show that coincidences are rare, but that they fall into hierarchies of surprise. So one story might have odds close to that of four of a kind in poker, and another close to that of a royal flush. But that's the idea. In other words, when you have some odds, in other words, I'm trying to show that these stories do have odds that are non-zero. Mm. They're not so freakily close to zero that they won't occur. In other words, and there is a kind of a philosophical law in mathematics called the law of truly large numbers. And what it essentially says is that if something has a probability that is not zero, then it's bound to happen sometime. You know, it's kind of like the monkey problem. That I don't know whether people know the monkey problem,
If you gave them all typewriters?
Yeah. If you go back to 1913, the mathematician Emil Borel, he decided to tackle an age-old question about randomness. And could totally random events amount to something meaningful? And the more popular rendition of the question soon became, could a monkey randomly hitting the keys of a keyboard type out a Shakespeare sonnet? And the answer is yes. And in mathematics, if that answer is yes, then the monkey could, in theory, type out all the books in the Library of Congress, the largest library in the world. I compute the odds of the monkey typing just the first word of shall, mm-hmm. as in shall I compare thee to a summer's day. And it's about 8 million to 1, right? Mm-hmm. The poor monkey needs help, though. So you put 8 million monkeys together and maybe it will happen faster.
Well, right. And then you talk about how many humans there are. And certainly, you know, things are going to happen to people. But when you must get pushback from people who say, well, sure, I understand. There's a possibility out there of somebody running into somebody else. But me running into this person,
that's exactly
here?
It. And that's exactly it. You know, the odds of somebody running into somebody else is very, very high.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it's likely that right at this, as we speak now, there are people bumping into each other all the time, all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Ginther, the woman who won the lottery 4 times, if I say, gee, Joan Ginther, is she the one who... She is the one who won the lottery 4 times. The odds of that is septillion to 1. You know, it's incredible odds. If I say it's Joan Ginther ahead of time, but I'm saying it in retrospect.
Right.
If I say somebody will win, somebody in this country or in this world will win the lottery 4 times. The odds are pretty good.
Right.
I'm sure it happens very often.
Yeah, that's the amazing part. And you know, do you think it diminishes the magic in any way to say, well, I mean, you just look at how many people there are in the world and you're going to run into somebody? Or can we still have the magic about these coincidences?
The magic is in the beauty of the story.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what it really amounts to. It's the beauty of it, and it's also the meaningfulness of it.
Hmm.
Because many of these stories are very meaningful. They lead to other things because, you know, there are romances that are there are romances that happen because of synchronicity. There are romances that happen all the time because of just simple coincidences.
Mm-hmm. Let me get a couple more in here. Susan in South Woodbury says, some years ago, I was taking my 3 children to visit Sturbridge Village, going down Route 91 through Massachusetts. We pulled off at a scenic overlook and got out of the car. Standing next to our car, we found my brother Joel, who lives in Portland, Oregon.
Mm-hmm.
He and my nephew were on a college tour. We looked at each other and laughed and had a short conversation, then went on to our respective planned stops. I've been shaking my head over that coincidence ever since. It didn't seem real. And Susan took pains to point out neither of them had known the other was on this trip. And let's get another one in here.
Can I comment on that?
Of course,
just a minute. It's also, it happens that you could have missed your brother. In other words, the surprise was in meeting your brother, but what if you had just missed him just by
mm-hmm.
10 minutes?
Mm-hmm.
This happens all the time, too. We just don't notice the misses.
Well, yeah, we don't know about them.
We don't know about them.
Yeah. Huh. Let's go to Chris calling in from Hinesburg. Hi, Chris. Go right ahead.
Hi there. I had a strange, this is another person coincidence. I lived in Germany as a child, and in second grade, there was some celebration, and I can't quite recall what it was, but the second graders had to choose a king and queen of the second grade. So I was chosen queen. This little boy was chosen king. I have a picture of us with little silly cardboard crowns on.
Uh-huh.
Fast forward 50 years, and I was in the old Ben Franklin in South Burlington, which I rarely went into to get something, and I had this funny feeling someone was following me. It was creepy. So I kind of kept looking over my shoulder, and the feeling just increased. And finally, I came around one corner, and this man is standing there, and he looks right at me, and he says, Christy? And I said, David? And this was the king from second grade in Germany, who now lived in California, had been visiting a friend in New York and decided to take a drive to Vermont.
Wow. And I'm impressed that you two were able, as adults, to recognize the second grader in each of you. What a cool story, Chris. Thanks. Let's go to Edward in Montreal. Hi, Edward. You're on.
Hi. Many of these uncanny coincidences are seem to be as probabilistic and given a prosaic explanation. But I know that in many there are conceptions in physics that posit that we may be, this reality may be embedded in like a higher dimensional system. So when I'm inclined to favor the view that that we don't exactly know what's going on. We're not necessarily, events don't necessarily follow cause and effect, linear progression. Like we could be embedded in a structure that we don't fully understand, and thus these uncanny coincidences occur because we're expecting linear cause and effect, whereas the situation we're in is more complicated than that. Do you care to comment?
Yes, I would comment. Yes, this is what Jung's synchronicity is all about. I mean, he really felt, and he talked to physicists about this as well, that in fact that there's something else out there. Kind of like a gravity question or radio wave question. He felt that there was something else out there that gave us these things, but also that it somehow the mind itself has imbibed all of this. So that we know about these things because some people pay more attention to them because they are more in tune to whatever is out there. I mean, if you read Jung's synchronicity books, this is what he is addressing, exactly what you're talking about. I think, I wouldn't have believed that before I started research on this book, but I'm inclined to agree with you and agree that there is something else out there that is not simply a question of odds or chance that we can actually pin down.
What about this question from Silas, who asks, what's the relationship between the math of random and the math of chaos, if any? Can random exist in a state of absolute order, or is a degree of chaos required?
A degree of chaos is required, especially in the physical world. There's no such thing as total mathematically theoretical randomness in the physical world. I mean, when you're looking at those little ping pong balls falling down the machine that's going to determine the number of a lottery, that's pretty nicely random, but it's not really random. It's not completely random. There's nothing in this world that's really random. That that coin that's being tossed at the beginning of a Super Bowl, that's not a random thing. That's not a random event. In fact, one could simply flip a coin and have it come up the way that one wants, because most coin flips are not really spinning coins. They're just precessing coins where the top is really just making you believe that it's turning around, but it's not really, and it's falling down on the face that it began with. So that's one thing about coin tossing. But the other is that if you look at randomness itself, there really is no such thing. If you can make a random machine to determine the odds of what the number is going to be in the lottery pick, that would be a colossal thing, but it doesn't exist.
Okay, what about this? We also got a note from VPR classical host Kari Anderson, who says, when my dad was teaching statistics, one of his favorite games was the birthday paradox. Mm. In a room of 23 people, there's a 50-50 chance that two will have the same birthday. And you write about this in the book, too. Could you explain that?
Yes. There again, we're not saying which two people in that room are going to have the same birthday. We're saying there are two people in a group of 23 people. The odds are better than even that they will have the same birthday. That's what we're saying. We're not defining the two people, just as we weren't defining who Joan Ginther is. Was who won the lottery four times.
So Joseph Mazur, after publishing this book, The Math and Myth of Coincidence, and now being the repository for so many other people's stories.
It's quite a job, I tell
you. Yeah. Well, are you sick of them? I mean, do you get bored?
No, not at all.
But so many of these stories, it's like, listen to this. This is amazing. And if you weren't the one experiencing it, it's not that amazing.
Well, that's true. It's more amazing to the person experiencing it, but they are wonderful stories. And every day I hear a new one that, you know, I wish I had infinite time to write this book because I would include many more. They're just unbelievable stories. I mean, there's no time to talk about some of the really spectacular ones on the air, but they really are spectacular, and I'm hearing about them every day.
That's Joseph Mazur, a mathematician and a professor emeritus at Marlborough College, speaking with VPR's Jane Lindholm. We interviewed him this spring about his book, Fluke, The Math and Myth of Coincidence. The book tells 10 true stories of fantastic coincidences and then calculates the probabilities of these things happening. Coming up, your weekly errand to drop off trash and recycling got a lot prettier recently if you go to a transfer station in Chittenden County. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari. If you frequent any of the transfer stations in Chittenden County, you may have noticed some changes to the big metal shipping containers you throw your recyclables into. The Chittenden Solid Waste District initiated a public art project that had local artists paint the receptacles with bright graphics. And they're pretty striking. This spring, when the project launched, Vermont Edition's Jane Lindholm met up with CSWD's marketing specialist Johnny Finity and with artist Mary Lacey to see a few of the artful recycling containers and to learn about the project.
We have here three recycling containers, I suppose we're supposed to call them. No longer dumpsters. Is that not? I'm getting shake of the head. Johnny, we don't call them dumpsters.
Recycling containers.
Okay, so they're recycling containers and they're 22 feet long, right? And these ones are not the bland green container that may be rusted over. These are gorgeous. Mary, what's going on?
Johnny and I actually met in the fall of last year when I was working on a previous project, the silos at dealer.com. And he talked about these dumpsters being such a viable and unexpected canvas. And that's really where the ideas started. He also talked about the recycle paint program that CSWD runs in there. Toxic waste depot, where people bring all of their leftover paint and then they recycle it into big new colors. And so at least 25% of all the paint used to make these containers are also from that recycled paint itself.
And you put together a team of 8 artists, including you, to do these containers?
Yeah, there's a total of 11 artists, 8 containers, because Anthill is 3 people and the last container is 2 people. But 8 individuals are teams.
It's beautiful public art because so many people do come and drop off their recycling at the transfer stations around Chittenden County. But you have sort of a goal beyond just having beauty in these scenes. You actually are trying to highlight something.
Yeah, so this is the art of recycling. It's really a celebration of recycling. And so when I first met Mary and saw this public engagement, the community just like loving the work that she was doing, I thought, you know, we have these really functional mobile canvases that people are interacting with on a daily basis to do something really good for the environment, for the community. And it was a great opportunity for her to bring together a team of artists in the community and strengthen that piece, and to use the artistic vision, a lot of color, recycled paint, to give a message that what you're doing has some intrinsic motivation, but it also has, you know, a big part to play in building a more beautiful community.
How do you think it does that? I mean, you can also just imagine people, it's maybe a Saturday afternoon or whatever day you're doing your recycling and your trash drop off, and it's like, I just need to get this done. Great, that's a beautiful container, but I'm still just going to throw my recycling in it, and I don't care what it looks like.
Yeah, I'm not expecting the art to actually, you know, drive people to say like, oh, I need to recycle more because there's out of the container. But it does create a more subtle emotional connection with recycling. When you drop your recyclables off in a beautiful container, you just have a better feeling about it. We get comments all the time. The drop-off center operators have been saying the public response to this has been amazing. The operator here at the Burlington Drop-Off Center actually said it was a home run for the district, the way he describes people's feedback. So they really love coming to the drop-off center and seeing this colorful part of their regular routine. And besides just actually having this interaction here, these containers move all over Chittenden County. Once they fill up here at the Burlington Drop-Off Center, they get taken to the materials recovery facility, the recycling center in Williston. They unload the recyclables, and then they're taken to a different drop-off center And so it was also a way, Mary put it really well, that it's a way of making the invisible visible. You know, when you see these containers going down the road, you know, you can see the impact that the recycling has in a very visual way. Whereas before, actually, I didn't even notice these green containers going down the road because they're green. They're easy to miss. But you can't miss these.
Mary, before we started rolling, you were saying you actually saw one an hour ago, and the excitement in your voice in saying you saw one on the road going somewhere was pretty cool, even though you've seen all of these and you've been such a big part of the project. So that resonates with you too?
Yeah. For me personally, and I think for many people, one of the challenges overcoming waste and reducing it and doing it responsibly is it disappears from your sight after you dispose of recycling or trash or whatever, and remembering that just because it's not in your sight, it does not go away. And so that's my favorite part of them being seen in transit, is that it's even one step further into the unexpected realm of like remembering. I'm more passionate about art being put into an unexpected location versus something that you seek out within a closed space.
I keep staring at this one in front of us, which is the one that you did. Can we go right up to it and you can tell us a little bit about what you were thinking when you were painting it, what your strategy was, and what it evokes for you?
Well, the content of it, it's an abstract mural of Chittenden County. So we're looking at, right now, downtown Burlington, the waterfront. We are right here.
That's where we are on the map.
It's the area that this CSWD, that the recycle waste is taken care of, and I love the idea of people coming up and being like, where's my house, or like, where's this, or where's that. It kind of evokes some interaction, some play there.
Were there any challenges, like physically challenging aspects to working on this kind of container? I mean, you're pretty familiar now with working on various different kinds of materials as the sort of canvas for your work, but what about this one, these containers?
The ridges were very difficult. Like, they're difficult to paint, but I think standing back and in transit, they don't affect the design as much as the artist probably thinks in the moment.
This was the first container that we painted in the whole project, and so it was, you know, we still didn't know what was going to happen. It was like there's this big open end to the project. And it was really exciting to see it all come together. You know, we had just moved into this warehouse space in Essex, this giant warehouse that was donated by Bob Miller from Miller Realty. And so we were, you know, this was this tiny little container inside of this enormous, like, airplane hangar of a warehouse. And Mary's just sitting in there, you know, making these small shapes on this giant container. And so some of the sense that I feel when I look at this is, you know, the sense of accomplishment of really making this project come to fruition. Yeah.
Well, you're the only artist here, but will you show us the other two? Both of you can describe what we're seeing, because there are three here. We got lucky. You guys didn't expect three to be here, just Mary. So let's look at these other ones. This one is, the Anthill Collective one. And you can probably guess, because it has ants on it.
Well, my favorite part about this one, when we did mine, it was like the first one, and we were like, oh my God, it's so bright. And it was like, but they totally outdid me on the brightness thing, and it's awesome. that the color in the sky.
And this one has sort of a more graffiti style. Mm-hmm. And Johnny, this actually has a recycling theme too, even though it may not be initially obvious to people. The ants, what's up with the ants?
Yeah, so Anthill had a great concept for this from the very beginning, of using the recycled paint as a background of this like explosion of color. And the ants, to them, I mean, they got the concept of the whole project right off right from the start, because the reason they're called Anthill Collective, the reason that ants are a big part of their image, is that they're a community that uses all of their resources and they don't waste anything. And so it was a perfect tie-in to this whole project, because the art of recycling isn't just about recycling. It's a bigger landscape of ideas that includes everything that we do to reduce our impact on the environment and reduce waste that we send to the landfill.
What's amazing is how different just these are. I mean, I know there are five others, and some are still being created, but they're all drastically different.
And that was very intentional, was to have a really strong variety. I like this one because it totally changes the color. There's no green in here. It is not a green dumpster. It is a totally different spectrum coming at you. And then the detail in the stencils on this one is mind-blowing. The detail in it gets you to go up real close to them. Getting anyone to go up real close to a dumpster.
Not a dumpster.
Oh, my God. Don't tell. A container.
When you look at these containers, Johnny, and you look at the future of them, these are working containers, and the way the artwork looks is going to change over time.
Well, these containers, without being painted, last, I think, about 7 to 8 years before we sell them. And we hoped at the start of this project that these murals would last at least a couple of years. And so I'm really curious to see how they wear over time.
That was Johnny Finity of the Chittenden Solid Waste District and artist Mary Lacey talking with VPR's Jane Lindholm last spring. The very large, brightly painted Art of Recycling containers can be found rotating through various CSWD recycling drop-off sites. And that's Vermont Edition for today. Our program is produced by Sam Gale Rosen and Meg Malone. Our directors are Mary Williams and Liam Connors, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Rick Zingari. Thanks for listening.